We're looking for Representative Pearson, but...
Not made the same stand.
Yeah, I saw that.
What's your business in Gray?
And I'm like, wait a minute.
What kind of business do you have?
Again, there's already laws.
Vega Peterson?
Yeah.
We think she's testifying on the PAC, but it's not for the front of the...
Okay. Are we starting? Maybe?
Right.
Oh, yeah, which one was there?
What?
It says wage theft day.
He's got the light on.
And some other things, too.
Good morning. I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Business and Labor. Committee, we have several bills to go through today. I'm going to start at the bottom of the list and work our way up. That I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2006 and concurrently open a public hearing on House Bill 2007. Jan, would you give us a brief description of the two bills?
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2006 makes the practice of paying employees of the opposite sex who hold equivalent jobs at different wage rates an unlawful employment practice, and it defines equivalent job. There are no amendments. There is a letter of support from Governor John Kitzhaber. House Bill 2007 makes disciplinary action against an employee who inquires about or discloses wage information an unlawful employment practice, and it provides the employee a private right of action. Also a letter of support from Governor John Kitzhaber.
Great, thank you. And up first we have Senator Rosenbaum. Good morning and welcome, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, I am State Senator Diane Rosenbaum from District 21. Very pleased to appear today in support of House Bills 2006 and 2007. I should be joined soon by Representative Vega Peterson. I think she thought that the hearing was set for 8:30, so she should be here soon. But I'll go ahead, and Commissioner Bakken is here as well. Prior to my election to the Oregon Legislature, I served as chair of the Oregon Commission for Women from 1993 to 1998. And as a legislator, I have focused on joining workforce issues and women's issues in my role as past chair of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance and as the current Senate Majority Leader. I'm proud to appear in front of you today as chief sponsor of these bills because I have seen our families, our communities, and our economy flourish when women have a fair shot at getting ahead, not just getting by. Right now, we know that women in Oregon earn roughly 79 cents for every dollar that their male counterparts earn, despite the equal pay laws that we already have in place. This is only slightly better than the national average, which is 70 cents on the dollar. And for minority women, this wage gap is even greater. Despite our equal pay law, Oregon is failing to ensure that women receive comparable wages for positions that require comparable skills, background, education, and experience. House Bill 2006 will alleviate persistent gender-based disparities and propel Oregon forward. Although two-thirds of working women in Oregon are the primary or co-breadwinners in their families, right now they take home less income and are less likely to earn wage raises and promotions, earn fewer retirement benefits, and accumulate lower lifetime wealth. Pay inequality not only impacts these women, but directly impacts children and other adults who depend on these women's incomes. Oregon does not stand to benefit from persistent economic securities like pay inequality. It is necessary to not only acknowledge the importance of securing working women the protections to speak openly and transparently about their wages but enact policies that ensure those protections. House Bill 2007 would prohibit retaliation against Oregon's working women and employees who discuss employment practices and salaries. I truly appreciate the hard work that has gone into crafting these bills, and especially want to thank my co-sponsor, Representative Vega Peterson, from whom you will hear shortly, and our Labor Commissioner, Brad Avakian, who is also here this morning, and members of the Civil Rights Council for the time they dedicated to exploring this important issue. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I urge you to fulfill the promise of pay equity in Oregon by voting in support of House Bills 2006 and 2007. Oregon's working women, their families, and our communities deserve a fair shot at a fair wage, and we must act now. I began my working career almost 40 years ago, and I recognize that we have made significant progress in that time toward equal pay. But there is still work to do. That is why I'm a proud chief sponsor of House Bills 2006 and 2007. I look forward to working with you this session to promote policies that work for working women, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions of the senator? Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Senator, just kind of going through it and everything and looking at some of the laws that we have in place, that this appears to kind of change things a little bit, but I'm just wondering what made you bring this bill forward? Do you feel that business owners in the state are just basically discriminating against women and look at women lesser than their men counterparts in the workplace, or what made you bring this bill?
Well, I certainly wouldn't say that, and I think that most employers, the vast majority of employers, want to do the right thing by their employees. But if you look at the statistics that I talked about earlier and this persistent wage gap of 79 cents on the dollar, it's hard to argue that our current laws are adequately addressing that, or we wouldn't have such a large gap. So it's really that, just the simple facts of it, that caused us to introduce these bills.
If I may follow up. I think
follow up.
The wage gap is 79 cents, or the wage gap is 21 cents on the dollar?
Well, the amount that women earn on the dollar in comparison to their male counterparts is 79 cents. So the gap, you're right, would be 21 cents.
No, I'm just kind of curious, why didn't you How come other minorities were not included in this, and it was just women that were singled out? Because the Hispanic community, I think we've seen, was like 73 cents that they were paid on the dollar, and some different things, different testimony that we've had, different sessions here and everything. Why did you single out one group and not include everybody in this?
Well, this is the problem that we are here to address this morning. There certainly are other proposals which I would support. As I said in my testimony, the gap is even greater for other groups, and that is a problem as well. But these bills are about pay equity for the women of Oregon.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Doherty.
Thank you. So, Senator Rosenbaum, thank you for being here. And so, it's basically, the issue is not what the job is, but it's the idea that if I have the same degree and the same years of experience and the same responsibilities as my male co-worker, then I should be paid the same as my male co-worker. Is that
yes,
what the
that's
principle
well
behind
put,
this is?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, the basic principle is equal pay for equal work. And that should apply. And as you point out, when there's qualifications and job duties that are the same, the pay should also be the same, not this disparity that we're seeing.
Yeah, follow up. And so it's not necessarily if I have a different job with different qualifications and so on, I may be making less because
yes,
of what the job
absolutely.
Is. And that could be part of not only females, but minorities and so on.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Doherty.
Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, you indicated that there are other references, and there are, to pay equity in the statutes, and I'm wondering why those are not being followed.
Well, I think that's probably a question, Mr. Chair, Representative Kenemer, that you could put to the Labor Commissioner, who I think will be your next witness.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, so hypothetically, if Representative Doherty and I were in the same workplace and we both had the same level of education, same job description, both say managers, co-managers, but she consistently outworked me or showed more talent than myself, should I be paid the same as her? I think we could all say would probably be the case anyway.
I think, you know, no one would say that people always need to be paid exactly the same, but I think the pattern that we're seeing is a significant gap, and that's what this bill is intended to address, that if two people are doing the same work, they should be being paid the same as a starting place.
I would agree. Follow up.
Follow up.
So how would you say this improves upon 652.220?
Well, as I said earlier, we have laws on the books, but they're not adequate because we still see these persistent gaps despite them. So I think by spelling out the requirement that two jobs with the same duties, the same qualifications, pay the same, and then the other bill, which says that if you talk about your pay, you can't be retaliated against for that. That should strengthen people's ability to enforce those rights.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bonetto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the Mr. Kenemer, or Representative Kenemer, I wanted to follow up on something he said, I think, and that was that if they're not enforced right now, what makes you think that they, under this bill here, that they would be enforced?
Well, I think for one thing, Mr. Chair and Representative Barreto, as I said in answer to the previous question, people may be afraid to invoke the rights that they currently have under the law because of fear that they're going to be retaliated against or even lose a job because they do so. So the second of these two bills, House Bill 2007, simply says that you have the right to file a complaint under existing law or under the other companion bill, and you can't be retaliated against, you can't lose your job, you can't be demoted, you can't be have your pay reduced because you simply invoke the rights that you have under law.
Follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
And then Representative Doherty mentioned professional or if the education is the same. Do you see in the disparity in the studies that you have found, is that primarily in the professional workplace or is that in the general workplace?
It's really both. And, you know, even in categories where women predominate in those jobs, we still see a gap that we don't think should be there. In fact, I think the problem may be even worse in those professional categories that you just referenced.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony early on a Monday morning, Senator.
Glad to start the week with you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I hope we have a good week. So up next, I'd like to have Brad Avakian, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Brad Avakian, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I appreciate you inviting me to share a few thoughts on equal pay this morning. And I thought what might be helpful to commit to the committee is for me to just give you a very brief history on how these bills ended up before you. A couple years ago, I helped bring together some civil rights advocates, folks from Oregon's business community, created the Oregon Council on Civil Rights in order to advise both me, the Bureau, and other elected officials in Oregon on important civil rights matters facing the state. And the first task that I gave them was to explore equal pay for equal work. They did an exhaustive study of cities, states around the country and other countries around the world on efforts that had been made in eliminating wage disparities and produced an equal pay for equal work set of recommendations, which can be found on our website. that aided the drafting of some of these the bills that you're going to have before you. What we were looking for were real solutions to eliminating the wage gap that Senator Rosenbaum mentioned, women earning 79 cents on the dollar compared to their male counterparts in the same or similar jobs. And as Representative Widener pointed out, that wage disparity is even greater for people of color versus white men on the job, and especially for women of color versus their white male counterparts on the job is the biggest disparity. And so the bills that you have before you this morning are two in an even larger set that we believe are all geared at eventually eliminating those wage disparities. That's the history behind them. I think with that I'm going to stop because I know a few of the questions that the representatives had are going to get probably to the heart of what you really want to be hearing this morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner, for bringing this important issue forward. I'm very supportive of the concept. Just curious if you could just flesh out a little bit for the record, how is this different than what already exists under a sex discrimination claim under Title VII or under ORS 659A?
In 1955, Oregon really got ahead of the curve in passing its equal pay statute. It's in the wage and hour statutes, the one that Representative Hurd mentioned in Chapter 652. Did it far ahead of Congress acting. What we would like to see is that that same concept of prohibiting wage disparities exists in the state civil rights laws, Chapter 659A. Since I've been labor commissioner over the last 6 years, I don't think we've had one single claim filed under Chapter 652. I think there are a number of reasons for that. Most people think of wage disparities in terms of discrimination, in terms of civil rights. Many people don't even know that the Chapter 652 provision exists. And it doesn't have the same kind of teeth that the civil rights statutes have. In civil rights law, the agency has the ability in some cases, to issue cease and desist orders if there's illegal conduct occurring. In some cases, the ability to award general damages for the discrimination that's occurring. And many people think of it in terms of a gender type of a discrimination, and so they just naturally go to the civil rights statutes. We believe the law is clearer for the public if it's housed in civil rights laws in addition to the wage and hour laws, which, like I said, have never been used that I know of, and certainly not since I've been labor commissioner.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So, and I understand that and appreciate that. Just what I'm asking is, how is this different than a sex discrimination claim that's already under the
right.
civil rights law?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Fagan. In a garden variety gender discrimination claim where one individual is claiming they're being treated differently in the terms or conditions of their employment because either they're female or because they're male, but based on gender, that person needs to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that gender is the reason for the discrimination. In a wage claim or in a discrimination claim based on wage disparity under House Bill 2006 that you have before you, one would need to show that there's a difference in wages, that there is a difference in gender, but not necessarily the Title VII standard that gender is the reason for the difference.
Got it. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment really for purposes of legislative history. Many people think that, for example, when coming to testify on a bill, that creates legislative history, that the courts review. Actually, the courts review our discussions more than that. So I just wanted to say to the Court of Appeals that I really find Commissioner Avakian's testimony very impactful in my reasoning behind this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure the Court of Appeals will be very appreciative of that.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm just wondering, you know, just listen to your testimony and everything, and there hasn't been any claims or anything that's came forward. And when you described what they have to do to come forward, it sounded very reasonable to me. And I'm just wondering, could it be that it's really not as big an issue as we're making it to be? And we're trying to make something here that doesn't really exist because we cover it under current statute. We have good employers in the state of Oregon. The businesses that we have in Oregon are treating their employees fairly and taking care of their employees, and that's why we don't see any claims. And we're trying to make a mountain out of a molehill, or make a mountain out of something that doesn't exist, and open the door for trial attorneys to have litigation against a lot of our businesses.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I do not believe that that's the case. I do believe that we have a mountain and not a molehill that we just have not paid attention to, just like every other state in the country. The fact that women are earning 79 cents on the dollar compared to their male counterparts is not just something that was pulled out of thin air. There have been many studies done around the country and in Oregon to illustrate that that's the fact. And it's a problem that has existed throughout history, not just recently. So I do believe that the wage disparity is real. I do believe it's complex. I don't think that House Bill 2006 is the only vehicle that gets you towards eliminating the wage disparity, which is why when you look at the recommendations set out by the Council on Civil Rights, there's a host of things that, all working in concert with each other, we believe changes the culture of business in order to provide greater footing for women and people of color. 2006 does not do it alone. But House Bill 2006 at least provides a recognizable and usable vehicle for people when they know they're being paid differently in order to advance their claims forward. At the Bureau right now, wage disparity types of claims that are filed under our Civil Rights Division account for less than 2% of the claims that we investigate throughout a year. I think that is more an indication that the public isn't educated enough that they have got a right and how to pursue their right. And with the other bills you have coming before you, such as the one that prevents retaliation when an employee shares their wages voluntarily at work, changing the culture means making sure that people can even find out whether or not there's a wage disparity exists by being able to share their own wage information without any fear of retaliation. Those types of things in coordination with House Bill 2006 are what is going to allow Oregon to take the lead like it did in 1955 in taking that mountain head on rather than trying to dodge around it.
Thank you. And Commissioner, so you know, we are open under both bills right now, 2006 and 2007. Just Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Commissioner, I have a question, because what's really important to me is that I fully understand how we came to the 79 cents versus a dollar, that wage gap. Are we including in that research or in that number, if Representative Noss is a CEO of a company and he makes $500,000 a year, he's an employee of that company, but then he has female employees that are in the workforce that are making, say, $20 an hour. Is that all being lumped in to create this number?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, the answer is no.
Okay.
Those are statistics based on same or similar positions, and I would be happy. We'll send it to Ms. Nordland. We'll send you links to the studies that give you a little more information about it.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Bonetto.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Bakken, do you think this kind of legislation would make businesses tend to come to Oregon or to shy away from them if they were looking for a place on the West Coast to land?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think smart businesses today are figuring out that in order to attract the best talent, which will allow them to compete better within our state, outside of our state, and globally, that they need to be showing that they're going to treat their employees well and give them great careers. And we have examples of that in Oregon right now, like Ninkasi Brewing in Eugene, that is creating flexible workplaces, modernizing their work, reaching out to women and people of color on the understanding that they're going to be a more competitive and successful company when they do that kind of a thing. I think when Oregon takes the lead in providing equality at work, flexible workplaces for families, I think we are going to be become a more competitive economic engine than we are today.
Yep. Can I have a follow-up on that?
Yes, Representative Barreto, you can have a follow-up.
Thank
Excuse
you.
Me for...
I guess the point was this seems to open up an easier path for litigation from employees to employers. And litigation, I can tell you, costs a lot of money. And I don't believe that there are, I mean, just from my perspective, you know, a lot of businesses out there trying to take advantage of employees, like we're led to believe. However, when there's that opportunity for litigation, I would think that businesses knowing that would tend to shy away from that. I mean, we've seen over in our area down in Ontario, we've seen medical clinics move across the river over to Idaho just for that purpose because of caps on litigation. So it's a very expensive part of running a business.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, I appreciate very much your comments. I was a business owner for 15 years. I understand what it means to have to meet a payroll, pay benefits, take care of your employees, and that you need a business climate that supports you in order to be successful. I understand that. The notion behind these bills is not to create huge new avenues that will propel litigation. It's to be able to have effective enforcement when it's necessary. Oregon has a tremendous business community that will nearly always go the extra mile for its workers. But it's only fair to Oregon's workers to be able to have equal footing on the job, like these bills contemplate, as well as fairness for Oregon's employers that do play by the rules and deserve to have a level playing field on which to compete. Many of these concepts don't come only from employee advocates, but also come from members of the business community that have expressed to me personally and my agency that they're tired of getting outbid on jobs by companies that artificially decrease their labor costs for one reason or another, or will attempt to skirt the employment laws in order to get ahead of them in a competitive market. So what I contemplate by the equal pay bills before you is an effort to make our enforcement more strategic, more effective, not just more.
One more question, Representative Hurd.
Mr. Commissioner, so you spoke of good companies, and I agreed with you on what a good company is. When they look at an individual that's applying for a job, or when they're looking at giving people pay increases, it has nothing to do with race, gender, who their family's last name is, any of that stuff. But you said that it would make us more competitive, in your opinion, to have laws like this continue to be layered on what we already have. My question to you is, if I'm looking at Idaho versus Oregon, and I am a good company as we defined, why would I choose Oregon, which presents a higher liability to me, regardless of the fact that I am a good employer, versus Idaho that has fewer layers of this kind of legislation that creates a lesser liability? Tell me why we become more competitive by creating more liability for those good companies, as you put it.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know that I agree with the premise of your question that it is more liability. I think it is all in how it is implemented. We've had these arguments come up virtually every single time that we propose an employment or civil rights law to the legislature, and it has just never panned out in that way. But I do know this. I do know that if I'm a recent female graduate from the best engineering college in the country, and I'm looking for a place to go to start a great career. I'm going to look to businesses that are going to provide flexible workplaces and equal footing for me on the job. And if some other state does not provide that, I'm going to look to Oregon. And if I'm an engineering firm that wants to attract that kind of a talent, I'm going to welcome those types of laws. Because I know as a business, I'll be able to attract the top talent and be able to compete because of that at a whole different level than I will in a place that does not have the ability to attract that type of talent.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning, Commissioner. Thank you for coming early on a Monday morning and getting us started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Appreciate that. Representative Vega Peterson, did you wish to testify on House Bill 2006 and 2007? Both bills are currently open for public hearing.
Mr. Chair, if I could, before Representative Vega Peterson starts, are we going to have LC come in and actually describe what the difference is, existing law versus what this would do and what it would do to employers?
Probably not this time, but maybe in the future we will.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson, and I'm the state representative in House District 47. I'm not going to spend too much time going over things because I know you've already heard from two very capable and informed people on these bills. But I did just want to touch base on a couple of points that I want to make sure that are understood when we're talking about why we're bringing these bills forward in the first place. I'm sure you've already heard that on average, women in Oregon only earn 79 cents per every dollar that men earn. This is actually even greater when you're considering women of color. If you compare what African American and Latino women earn compared to men in the state, it's actually, especially white men, it's actually only 50%. So we have a long way to go in getting to be truly equitable in the wages that we're seeing between men and women. Now, when you talk about wages, you look at it in terms of paycheck, and it may not be that much of an impression. So what I wanted to touch base on is what we're talking about in terms of lifetime earnings for women. We have over two-thirds of the breadwinners or co-breadwinners in the United States are women. This means that inequities in their paycheck have long-term effects for the families that they're supporting and for the children that they're raising. What we've done is looked at this problem in Oregon and figure out how we can actually address this issue. Oregon's been a leader in pay equity. Since 1955, Oregon had a pay equity law on the books. So we've been forward-thinking on this for a long time. However, we know that this is still a problem. So what we did with House Bill 2006 is try to create an apples-to-apples definition of what actually equivalent jobs mean. And so we are creating a definition in statute of equivalent jobs to make sure that when people are comparing things, we're having an equal playing field, so we lose some of the arguments on what is exactly equal, what isn't exactly equal. It will create some clarity in the law for us as policymakers going forward in pay equity. We also, in House Bill 2007, we are making sure that we are strengthening our equal pay laws so that if an employee decides to share information about their salary with a coworker, there can be no retaliation from their employees. Now, there is an exception to this with human resources. They are not allowed to share information that they would have as part of their job. But otherwise, having this flexibility, having this transparency in order to share information goes really at the heart of the problems that we're seeing with trade, with wage inequalities, because people don't know if they're being treated unfairly in terms of salary or not. And that's what House Bill 2007 does, is try to get at the root of that problem. So I'm happy to answer any questions you have, but I'm very, but I would urge your consideration of these two bills seriously. This is an issue that we know has been going on for too long. It's something that we know affects people at all parts of the salary range, from the lowest paid workers to what we saw when the Sony files were released this summer. Even at the highest paid Hollywood actresses and corporate executives, we found out that even at that level, there is wage inequalities between men and women for no other reason than gender. So this is a chance for us to take a really positive step in the direction of wage inequality this session. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you. I guess I'm trying to understand why we need another law to do what's already prescribed in law. You know, I'm looking at 652.222 and 1 A and B. It says no employer shall in any manner discriminate between the sexes in the payment of wages for comparable for work of comparable character, the performance of which requires comparable skills, and B, pay wages to any employee at a rate less than that at which the employer pays the wages to employees of the opposite sex for work of comparable character, the performance of which requires comparable skills. It seems pretty straightforward English, and I wonder why we're not enforcing the law that's there.
So there has been, we have been a leader in this. Oh, I'm sorry, Chair Holvey and Representative Kenmore. We have been a leader of this in Oregon in terms of having laws on the books, but it's exactly what equivalent jobs mean has been it hasn't been in statute, so it's been a bit of a judgment call in terms of making a case that an equivalent job and then there was disparity in wages. So House Bill 2006 addresses that issue. It also adds enforcement of equal pay as a civil right into the civil rights statute, which is a big change from what we've had before. It recognizes the importance of pay equity and moves that into that statute to address it as a civil rights issue.
Other questions? Representative
yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. You mentioned that Oregon is taking the lead on this and that they're the leader among the states. You're one of the sponsors of this bill. Did you look at other states to see if they had any models like this and what it has done and how it's affected those states?
Yep. So Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto. So when I said that, I meant that because we've had pay equity on the books since 1955, we've traditionally been a leader on this. And this is another chance for us to be a leader in getting some of this type of law in statute. As far as what's happening in other states, I don't have specific states that I can refer to you, but I did take part this summer in the White House Summit on Working Families, and that was a gathering of folks from all over the country who are working on issues like pay equity, and there was a lot of discussion there about things that could be done on pay equity, and so this is a discussion that's happening all across the country, not just in Oregon.
Representative Widener, question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess with you being one of the sponsors, Representative Peterson, I'm just wondering, you weren't here when the commissioner was testifying everything, and I wonder why he said he hasn't had any claims, so he hasn't had anything to enforce, is one of the things he said, and I'm just wondering, could this be a bill where we're opening the door for trial attorneys to make a lot of money through litigation? So we have a lot of attorneys in this building that I know would really like to see this bill go through.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, that honestly never really entered my mind in looking at putting these bills forward. This was actually we really want to make sure that there is equity in terms of wages that women are getting for the jobs that they're doing that are equivalent to men, so that we're fighting those inequalities so that, you know, over their lifetime, they can continue to earn as much as they deserve because of the work that they're doing. That's the heart of why we're bringing these bills forward.
Representative Fagan.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I'd prefer Representative Widener, please not impugn the motives of other attorneys in the building. People support this bill maybe because they support working families, so I don't appreciate the reference to trial attorneys supporting this bill for the reference that he made. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we do need to be careful about impugning the motives of anyone. So with that, thank you very much,
thank
Representative
you.
Vega Peterson.
Thank you.
Up next, I'd like to have Kate Newall and Matt Swanson.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of Family Forward Oregon. We are happy to be here supporting both House Bill 2006 and House Bill 2007. I feel like it's hard to follow such great testimony, and I'll spare you repeating some of the same facts over again. But what we know is equal pay for equal work is still a far off reality for most women. Wage discrimination takes many forms, but it exists in all industries and at all ages for working women. You've heard that women make 79 cents on the dollar for what a man earns. I think even more dramatic are the impacts that it has on women of color, which is much more dramatic. In 2015, women in Oregon and across the United States are still being paid lower wages than men just because they're women. And I want to take a different kind of turn on this. This has dire consequences not only for women, but on the families that rely on them. Women in particular are affected by this wage gap, but their families also are. Women are more and more the primary or sole breadwinners in their families. Here in Oregon, there are 166,000 family households that are headed by women. And 34% of those families are living on incomes below the federal poverty line. When women and mothers aren't earning equal pay for equal work, Oregon families suffer. Women in the workforce are essential to our economy, and their wages make the difference between a family that's just scraping by and one that's able to get ahead. And what we know at Family Forward is there's not just one policy solution to solve this wage gap. It's several different factors. But we do have an opportunity this year to address some of the barriers that prevent women from getting equal pay for equal work. One of those is paycheck transparency, allowing workers to talk about wages and salaries without fear of retaliation. House Bill 2007 provides these protections for workers when discussing their wage and salary information. A national study found that 61% of private sector employees have been discouraged or prohibited from discussing wage and salary information. When women or people of color don't know what their colleagues are earning, it's difficult, if not impossible, for them to know if they're being paid equitably for their work. Right now in Oregon, this adds up over a lifetime. It's not just 79 cents on a dollar. It's thousands of dollars over their lifetime that they're not earning. And that compounds into they have less to be retiring on when they retire and are living in poverty their entire lives. When more and more families are relying solely on a woman's paycheck for their livelihood, we have to address wage inequality to ensure that the financial strength and success of all women and families in Oregon. House Bill 2006 will ensure that women are paid equally for equivalent jobs and are not discriminated based on gender. Family Forward sees both of these bills, House Bill 2006 and 2007, as important steps in achieving equal pay for equal work here in Oregon, and we urge your support.
Mr. Swanson, please.
Thank you, Vice Chair Barton and members of the committee. My name is Matt Swanson. I'm here representing the Service Employees International Union. I would just say that, you know, as SEIU, we have a long history of working on pay equity. Back in the late 80s, actually, I was on my first picket line as a 11-year-old walking with my mom, who worked at then CSD, now SCF, about really a strike that was all about pay equity. Many state employees are women and have long been the trailblazers on issues of pay equity. I think what we find now is in a number of industries, healthcare, really across the board, when workers who are not organized come to us with questions about their workplace and how they can improve their wages and working conditions, an issue that often will be raised is whether or not there's equity across gender within the workplace. And rather than, I think everyone stole all of my good statistics. So that's the problem with batting going up last here, is that we really believe that this is an issue that we're proud to stand up with Family Forward and others on. Pay equity is an issue that continues to hold working families back, and we believe it's time to add tools to the toolbox of those who need to have their wages improved so they can support their families. So with that, thank you.
Questions of this panel? Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Just real quick, for SEIU, do you find that your members, female members, make less than the male members of the SEIU?
Are you talking within?
Is there pay the disparity in the union membership of SEIU?
What I'd say is when there's a collective bargaining agreement in place, we find that there is much less pay equity, or excuse me.
Disequity.
There is much less disparity. There's a common understanding of what wages are. It's spelled out on paper. It's contractually agreed to. So that's not an issue we find. Something that we definitely see is that there are professions in Oregon that still need to catch up. The care providing is a really underpaid profession in our state. It's an important role, but we find that you know, when you look at what happens with certain populations, that's certainly where people fall behind. But within a collective bargaining agreement, you can't really pay people different rates based on their sex or gender.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
So the care profession, you're finding it's much underpaid, or you went to that. So men are paid more in the care profession than women?
No,
because you said the whole profession is paid less, and this bill's not about that. It's about equal pay.
Certainly. Sorry, as a commentary on, I think, a profession that is predominantly women, well over 80% of our membership in that profession are women, and what I would say is they're definitely falling behind, but that's not the subject of the bill at hand. So that was where my mind went on that. So apologies if that was confusing.
That's okay.
Other questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair. You mentioned poverty level. I think you said 166,000 families where women or mothers are in the lead role. And what is the poverty level in dollars for, say, a single mom with two children?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I don't have that information right off the top of my head, but I'd be happy to follow up with it. And you're right, it is hydraulics between how many people are in the family and how much they make. So it differs if you're one household with two children versus three children or four children. But I would be happy to follow up with the committee with all of those scales.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Thank you very much. Up next, I'd like to have Betsy Earls and J.L. Wilson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm appearing before you in opposition to House Bill 2006, and it sounds like we have 2007 open as well, so also to 2007. AOI opposes House Bill 2006 not because we're in favor of pay discrimination, we certainly are not, but because the main effect of the bill is that it will lower the bar on discrimination claims that are based on wage differences between genders. And I think this has already been pointed out here this morning. Pay discrimination is already illegal and actionable for all protected classes under Oregon's employment discrimination statutes. ORS 659A030 states that it is an unlawful employment practice for an employer because of an individual's sex to discriminate against that individual in compensation or in the terms or conditions or privileges of their employment. So any member of a protected class, which includes anybody of certain gender, who alleges pay discrimination can get relief today under ORS 659A, either in civil court or through Boley's Civil Rights Division. House Bill 2006 essentially creates a duplicative right of action in the wage discrimination statutes, but there's one key difference. The proof necessary for a plaintiff to sustain a claim under 2006, as has already been pointed out, is substantially lower than what it would be under the employment discrimination statutes or through Boley's Civil Rights Division. And the burden of proof is shifted entirely to the employer under House Bill 2006. Employer liability for wage discrimination in Oregon basically requires the complainant to prove discriminatory motivation. But under House Bill 2006, there would be created a type of strict liability that requires no showing of intent to discriminate on the part of the employer. An employee would only need to prove two things. One, he or she was performing work that was comparable to that of coworkers of the opposite gender. And two, he or she was paid less than those coworkers. Under 2006, at that point, the employer would then be liable for the difference in wages unless he or she could prove, as an affirmative defense, that the pay disparity was based on a particular factor which is listed in the bill other than gender, and that the factor was applied reasonably. The absence of discriminatory motivation would not be a defense to a claim in the same way that it is under the discrimination statutes in place in Oregon right now. AOI believes that Oregon's employment discrimination's remedies and burdens of proof are entirely appropriate to issues of pay discrimination. And since there are myriad reasons for disparities in pay, including seniority, different skill sets, different motivations of the employee, educational attainment, et cetera, those remedies are already in place and appropriate. House Bill 2006 has the realistic potential to turn ordinary personnel disputes concerning a denied raise or other dispute concerning pay into a claim for actionable equal pay discrimination under the wage and hour statutes. Do you want to go ahead with
Thank
the
Thank you.
Next
go
thing,
ahead.
Sir?
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson, and I'm representing the Oregon State Chambers of Commerce on this issue. And I was more than happy to let Betsy just take the arrows on this one. But I think the small business voice really needs to be heard. And I am an employer. I have, depending on the season and the workload, anywhere between 25 and 32 employees. I sign a lot of paychecks. I employ folks, and my message to you is I feel like people are talking over business, because at the end of the day, we're the ones that have to implement and live by these regulations. And my message to you, which is my experience, is that the workplace is just so much more dynamic, and there are so many other factors at play in hiring decisions and decisions of promotion and the things that you want to do with your workforce that don't feed neatly into House Bill 2006. And 2006 could provide for some really absurd outcomes that I don't think that this committee would intend to have happen. And I'm going to give you examples, all of which have happened in my company in the last 6 months to a year, because they illustrate issues in which I would probably have a claim under 2006, but I'm pretty sure you don't intend for me to have a claim under 2006. One of which is I had a part-time employee at 20 hours who got a job offer, and she and her husband decided she needed full-time benefits. And she said, JL, without full-time benefits, I can't work for you anymore, and there's nothing more that I want to stay and work here. And so what she and I came to an arrangement is that I could do what I could absolutely do, which is she was going to go to work for another employer at minimum wage, but they offered benefits. I said, I can't pay you your same hourly, but I will guarantee you at least 32 hours and you will have fully paid employer benefits, but I have to reduce your hourly wage, because it just that those are the hydraulics. That's how it would work for me and my small company to bring you on full time. And it was the happiest day of her life. And her husband came in and the next day and shook my hand and thanked me for what I did for their family. And I have to tell you, there was just a lot of pride in being able to do that. But by the same token, where I would have probably an exemption under the current 652.220 with regard to a differential in wages between employees based on good faith factors other than sex, I can't even begin to tell you in House Bill 2006 what factors that decision would have to run through in order to defend myself from a claim. Because between similarly situated employees, she probably is paid less. But it's what I could do to bring her on as a full-time employee. And that was a mutual agreement, and I'm very proud of that. But at the same time, by the strictest definition of this law, it's probably not good. I had a situation where I had to give somebody an 18% pay raise because she was being lured away by another company, and I felt very strongly I had to retain this employee in order to keep her and keep her long term. Did that create a pay disparity between she and her similarly situated employees in my company? Absolutely it does. Is there a claim now that could in essence be enacted by her colleagues because now she is paid more than them because I had to find a way to keep her? Probably. And yet under the current law, 652.220, I probably have a differential in wages between employees based on good faith factors other than sex. Again, I can't even begin to see on these tests in House Bill 2006 where I might not be subject to a claim. And then one other point that I'd like to make with regard to a third situation. Not every employment decision you make in your company is about economics. Sometimes you just want to do right by people, and sometimes you don't want to be the guy who says, I'm sorry, but you can't show up here for work and you've got to do something else. I mean, sometimes you just develop that affinity with employees and they're not your most productive. And sometimes you keep them on just because you love them and you want them part of the family, but it's hard to make a business case for why that should be. And employers make those decisions all the time. And I made those decisions too. And yet, do you create pay disparities that might be subject to the new House Bill 2006? Probably. And I would argue that is a really absurd outcome that this committee would probably not want to have happen, but yet it's a reality. I can't even begin to describe lines 19 through 24, 25 of the bill and what that even means in terms of what I would have to defend on a strict liability claim. So I just ask you not to go there. ORS 652.220 more than adequately gives wage protections based on sex. It's already current law. The second piece of 2006 puts wage discrimination claims in ORS 659A. That's already there. It's already in 659A030. So again, it's duplicative. There's just not a reason to do that. I'm going to turn my attention now to House Bill 2007 right quick. The thing that jumps off the page to me on this bill with regard to Section 2, Sub B, in terms of protections for those who make a charge, file a complaint, or institute or cause to be instituted an investigation, proceeding, or hearing, that's already covered in 659.030. It's also already covered in 659A199. And so that's essentially the third way to restate the same thing in ORS 659A. When I look at that sub A under Section 2, the thing that jumps off the page to me is the protections about inquiring, about discussing, or disclosing any manner the wages of the employee or of another employee. And so what I pose to you is what if somebody wants to discuss the wages of another employee without that employee's consent? Or what if that employee objects to their wage information being used by another employee? Are we really condoning that? I mean, to me, that would be hard as an employer to navigate that situation when someone brings up the wages of another employee against their will. And I would ask you to contemplate that piece. The other thing I'd say is, you know, if you're in small business, you better love talking about money with employees, because it is the thing they want to talk about. They want to talk about how much they're paid. I've had that conversation of my 30 employees. I probably had that conversation with 3/4 of them. And every time, if you're an employer, and I think a good employer, it's an invitation to you to talk about things that are really meaningful and substantive and help that employee gain purpose and give them a pathway to something better and a direction. And I think that those are all really good things. So I'm not shy about talking about money, and I'm not shy about giving people a pathway to be paid more. But I also know that, you know, I've had to take a few adverse employment actions, and I hate it. Honestly, it makes me sick. I just hate it because I don't like that conflict with other people, you know, as probably most bosses don't. But you have to, and I can tell every one of them I had that money conversation with at some point in time. And so I'm leery of this sub A because that becomes the basis for a claim that probably might not otherwise have existed. I would say that just in totality, the statute is already covered in 659A030 and 199. So again, it seems like it's the third way to say the same thing in statute, and I just don't think it's necessary. Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Listen, Betsy or JL, whichever one wants. But looking at this, would it be safe to say that this almost makes the employer guilty and has to prove that he's innocent if an employee makes a claim against him?
Thank you. Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, a claim under 652 or a 652 is essentially a strict liability claim, and the burden of proof is on the employer to demonstrate these things. The difference between a 652 claim and a 659 claim of the civil rights is you have to prove, as an employee bringing a claim under 659, it's my understanding you have to prove discriminatory intent. So there's a difference in burden of proof between the two sets of statutes. But yes, 2007 would essentially require an employer to demonstrate and have the burden of proof to demonstrate those things that are outlined in the bill. Or, excuse me, 2006.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Hurd.
I'm your favorite today, aren't I? Thank you, Mr. Chair. question I have is, and I had some questions earlier about the research from other folks that testified. Is there any research that'll show what the pay gap is when it's a male employer and what the pay gap is when it's a female employer? Because I'd be very interested in seeing that kind of research breakdown.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, when the boss, so to speak, is a male versus a female?
Right.
I'm not aware of any research like that.
Because I think it's a follow-up. Uh-uh. I think it's important to see what is the difference. Is there are male employers discriminating against women?
Women, yeah.
Are female employers discriminating against women?
Or men.
Or men.
Not seeing. Oh, Representative Fagan, question.
So I think one kind of comment, if I remember correctly, you noted that for this is for House Bill 2007, that for 659A199, you think that it already covers. And that's only if they're reporting conduct they believe is unlawful. So that's kind of a whistleblower claim. I don't see how just inquiring about what, you know, if I'm a female associate at a law firm and I am talking with other female associates and we're talking about the fact that we learned that another male associate makes more money, I wouldn't think that I'm covered under 199 because I'm not necessarily reporting something that I think is, I'm just, oh, is it true that he makes more? So I think that's a little bit of a stretch. I do hear your concerns about House Bill 2006 in terms of redundancy. So just kind of a general question. In fact, and the nice thing to note is this is definitely a bipartisan issue. I recall during the last gubernatorial campaign, the Republican candidate Dennis Richardson noted this would be his number one priority in office, would be enacting policies to combat wage and wage discrimination among the genders. So if you think that current laws are sufficient to combat pay discrimination, you know, how can you explain the fact that there is still this persistent 79 cents on the dollar gap for Oregon women?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fagan, I think that in terms of the gap that currently exists, JL has done a pretty good job of explaining how some of those disparities can exist. It comes down in a lot of cases to the amount of time a worker has devoted to the job, the amount of motivation that worker has devoted to the job, shifts in the employment market, and a million other things that could or could not be attributed to gender. And I'm not saying that there's not pay discrimination in Oregon. What I'm saying and what we're saying is that there are already statutes in place, and perhaps if this is a concern that's increasing in this state and among this legislative body, we should be looking more to those statutes instead of placing a duplicative statute in another statutory scheme.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions, I appreciate your testimony this morning. Up next, I have Marcia Kelly and
Trish Gardner.
It's Trish Gardner, right?
Trish Gardner. Just having a hard time reading it. My glasses are terrible. Welcome, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Trish Gardner. I'm here representing the American Association of University Women of Oregon, and I apologize for my poor penmanship. I guess you want me to proceed. This is the first time I've done this, so hopefully I don't make any egregious errors.
We'll let you know.
Thank you.
Yeah, they will. Don't worry.
Thank you. Yes. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I found it very interesting when I was looking at this issue that back in the 1930s, the federal government, I know not the state of Oregon, but the federal government actually required that women working for the government be paid 25% less than men. We've come a long way, but I think we need to come a lot farther. I'd like to make 2 points. One is I've located a report from the State of Oregon Employment Department, which indicates that in Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook counties, women earn 50% of what the average wage is for men in the entire state of Oregon. So there are disparities between communities. The other point I'd like to raise relates to a study that was performed by the American Association, or at the sponsorship of American Association of University Women, and it's entitled Graduating to a Pay Gap, which I suppose I could addend to say while also paying the same amount of tuition and fees, which we all know are substantial. But this report attempted to figure out why is it that women are being paid, at least in the situation of 1 year after college, 82% of what men were being paid for the same position. Again, slightly above the national average. The issues that were attempted to be sussed out were, you know, is it a different education, different occupation? Is it that men are choosing business and science, technology, women choosing social services, education? Is it a college major that follows that same kind of line? Is it a particular employment sector? None of these were found to be substantially contributing to the difference in the pay gap. There was some, but not substantially. And I think that speaks directly to why this law is needed today, which is a very clear statement on behalf of the legislature that, yes, this is still a problem. It still needs to be addressed. We may not be in the 1930s. We may not be quite there, but we have a long way to go. I would also say we support House Bill 2007, because without 2007, it's kind of hard to get to the pay equity of 2006. I've also heard today that, why do we need this? Hopefully the arguments that I've just posed answer that. But I think what this law does, aside from the legal technicalities of burden of proof and so on, it makes it clear that this kind of inequity should not continue. It's clear. It also demonstrates the importance that the legislature would accord the right of being able to have equal pay for equal work. I've also heard from business representatives that, you know, this is going to cost me money. I'm going to have to, you know, pay money in litigation, et cetera. Again, if the law is clear, it would seem to me that, you know, burden of proof, those kinds of things wouldn't be quite as onerous, for business people to defend. But at the heart of it, I think what we're talking about is productivity. People who are paid equally for the same work are going to be happier in their position. They're going to be more productive, which, forgetting the happiness factor, is going to be more productivity, more income for businesses, and so the economic ball keeps rolling in favor of both employer and employee. So thank you so much. I appreciate your attention, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. If you have any questions, I'd be delighted to answer them.
Go ahead.
Chair Hovey and members of the committee, my name is Marsha Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. You've heard about the 79 cents. You've heard about the fact that it's been stuck pretty much for a decade. I'm going to bring a different point of view on what the costs are and the cost to society. Some of you have served on healthcare committees and maybe know about the term dual eligible. These are people who are on both Medicare and Medicaid. So in Oregon, if you take the dual eligibles that are over 65, retirement age, you find that 62% of the people who are dual eligibles are women. And it varies between 60 and 70% in the last 10 years and decades. So what does this mean to the state? The state Medicare Medicaid dollars kick in on paying for premium help, deductibles, co-pays, and nursing home stays for people. And 62% of those people in this poverty situation qualifying for Medicaid are women. That could be totally attributable to their lack of pay in society over the years. And you're looking at me as the leading edge of the baby boomers. I won't tell you when I was born, but it was pretty close to the first part of the baby boomers. And the baby boomers are going to have a real effect on this, and we can't do anything about my generation. But we can do things so that we can make sure that the women in the baby boomlet generation are not going to be qualifying for this dual aid. And what did it cost Oregon? What I could find was in 2010, when you take the approximately $73 million of just Medicaid dollars paid for this age population, and you extract 62% of that, it's $45 million in Medicaid dollars alone for this population in Oregon. That affects businesses' bottom lines by taxes. That affects all of our bottom lines. And if we can stop this continuation, then we should be a healthier state for businesses. The federal poverty level is about $20,000 for a family of three. The dual eligibles can qualify to be dual eligibles up to about, it's 225% of the federal poverty level, and that's about $11,000 for a single person, which is where the most of the dual eligibles that I'm talking about would be, because mainly they're probably single women, possibly married. But anyway, it's not beneficial for the state to continue to not have an equal pay situation when at the other end we're paying. And let me give you just two examples of anecdotal and personal history. When I was first out of college, I worked for doctors for 2 years, and then I was trying to decide if I wanted to go to library school. So I took a job at the law library at Willamette. And I was there for about 9 months to a year. I was working directly under the catalog librarian, and someone else was hired into the department to be a clerical support to me, and I was in charge of her. I had a good employer. I went to the employer and said, why, with a college degree and 3 years of work experience, am I making less money than this young woman who just graduated from high school? And my employer, the dean of the law school, said, we've taken care of that. You'll see it on your next paycheck. But if there was not a good employer and they retaliated against me, I would have been out of a job and I was single. I would have been on unemployment. I also, when talking to a friend who has spent her entire career in housing, said that she interviewed a woman one time who was elderly, and she said, you know, I was working in a department with men, and they were making more money than I was, and I asked for pay increases so that I would make as much money and I would have as much money in retirement. And she said, I was turned down. So I just figured that my living in assisted housing, subsidized housing, is a payback for me not being able to make equal pay. So when you think about the long-term costs to society, don't think about just the women who are not making the same amount for comparable work. Think about what it's costing all of us as taxpayers and as businesses.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. It's an intriguing perspective about the dual eligibility and that impact. So thank you very much for your testimony. I'd like to move on. We have a large agenda. We've asked quite a few questions already. So with that, I'd like to close public hearing on House Bill 2007-2006 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2386.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure authorizes the Labor Commissioner to issue a temporary cease and desist order for violations of statutes governing prevailing wage rate, farm and construction labor contractors, wage and hour, and employment conditions. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. And up first, we have Paloma Sparks.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2386. The Bureau has brought forward this bill because we feel that we should close the loophole of we are missing one of our enforcement tools that we have in our civil rights laws that we do not also have in our wage and hour laws. Under current law, the Commissioner can issue a cease and desist order when either when we are in the midst of investigating and have probable cause that a violation has occurred and harm will come to the workers, or the harm is so severe that we need to halt it while we're investigating. The more common use of it is to add it as part of a final order. We have completed our investigation. We've reached a conclusion. We've gone through the process, and we include the cease and desist requirement as part of the final order going forward that an employer must not restart or continue that illegal activity. And we feel like this is a key tool to protecting workers, to add it to our wage and hour laws also. The vast majority of employers follow all the rules and treat their employees fairly. This is not a tool that's likely to come to affect most of employers. There's a small minority who will try and cut corners, and they create an unfair playing field for other employers, and they cheat their employees out of what they are entitled to. An egregious few will continue to violate even while the Bureau is investigating a violation or a complaint. We've seen that there is a small minority that can continue to ignore the laws, ignore our efforts. So for those rare employers, we need another tool to add to the toolbox. We feel like the Bureau can be more effective in holding these bad actors accountable by having this tool. And as we said, this would be most likely to be used as part of final orders. We do anticipate that where the harm is so severe, or there are more employees likely to be hurt by it going forward, that we would use this tool. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Not seeing any.
Thank you
very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Up next, I have Matt Swanson and Kate Newell.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today now representing UA 290, the Plumbers and Steam Fitters. We are supportive of House Bill 2386. We believe that giving Bully the authority to issue temporary cease and desist orders where there's probable cause to believe that there are ongoing wage and hour violations is important. It's important to protecting workers, and it's important in protecting employers against other employers who get an unfair competitive advantage by continuing to cheat workers. We believe this is a simple tool that will protect employees from further injury and will protect others from experiencing the same unfair treatment on the job. We believe just because an investigation is ongoing doesn't mean that there aren't some instances when employees aren't continuing to be harmed. And in those instances where there's probable cause to believe that there are harms continuing to happen, we believe that a temporary cease and desist order is fully appropriate.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Matt Swanson, still representing SEIU. I would agree with Ms. Newhall that this is a good bill, warranted to pursue some of the bad actors out there. I think that in our experience, this rule would be very well applied to some of the companies we see primarily in the janitorial or service industry. Obviously, 99% of the businesses are going to be doing the right thing, but when you have a group of workers that is quite vulnerable, typically work in graveyard, typically immigrant workers, they're not the group that's going to have the wherewithal or usually the functioning knowledge of how an agency would work to go through and actually stand up, fight back against bad practices. Giving the commissioner some authority to issue a cease and desist order of this sort would, we believe, help knock out some of the bad practices there and really provide a level playing field across all businesses in Oregon. So with that in mind, we offer our support. I think this is part of a slate of bills that folks were talking about. There are a lot of hydraulics that go into running a business. We think there's also a lot of hydraulics that go into creating a level playing field for all businesses. So this bill, coupled with some others you'll be hearing today, are pretty vitally important to ensuring that workers can receive a fair wage and that businesses are all held to the same standards. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony this morning. Up next, I have Mike Eliason and Betsy Earls. Welcome, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls, again, before you, representing Associated Oregon Industries. I apologize. Are we only doing 2386? Not both. Okay. So I'll just give you some comments about House Bill 2386 more generally, and then Mike, I think, has some more specific details he wants to talk to you about. AOI opposes House Bill 2386 because it gives the Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries quite a bit of broad new authority to issue cease and desist orders really without any notice to or hearing for the employer. Under Section 1, Sub 6, if the commissioner has reason to believe, not probable cause, just reason to believe, that an employer has violated any of the statutes in question, and you can see there's a long list there, including prevailing wage, wage and hour, and most of the general employment law statutes, he can issue what would, under this broad authority, amount to basically a stop work order. Under the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act, the employer would have the burden then of petitioning a circuit court to lift that order. So this is exactly the kernel of our concern about this bill. It shifts the burden of proof from the Bureau of Labor and Industries Commissioner to the employer again. So instead of the labor commissioner having to ask a court to issue such an order and proving that the employer is violating the law, the employer, once the order was issued, would have to go to court to have the order issued, to have the order lifted, and then would have to prove that they were not violating the law. And I think we all hear what the Bureau of Labor and Industries is saying about some of the employers that they're seeing that are sort of recurring problems in this area. But I would just point out to you that this authority goes far, far beyond anything that has to do with a small subset of employers. And it would become especially problematic in a situation where there's really a legitimate dispute about the validity of Boley's belief that a law is being violated. So here's an example of an issue in a prevailing wage case, which could be a real problem. And it's one of the statutory schemes that's covered by House Bill 2386, the prevailing wage laws. You have Contractor X, who's working on a large construction project, and he assigns work to a group of employees who are covered by a collective bargaining agreement. An inspector from Boley's prevailing wage unit happens along to the construction site and decides that the work should have been assigned to different employees that are paid a higher prevailing wage rate. Under House Bill 2386, the BOLI inspector can then issue a cease and desist order without notice or hearing. And first, that would be to pay back wages. But the problem is, if the employer protests that, the cease and desist order could extend as far as shutting down the work until the matter's settled. The employer basically then has two choices once the order is issued. They can either pay those back wages, or they can go to court and argue the matter. If they decide to go to court to contest the matter, it's entirely possible under this bill that their work could be shut down on the project until they either prevail in court or pay up. And once they pay those back wages, regardless of whether the money was truly owed, that money's gone. On the other hand, once they shut down, if they get shut down through a cease and desist order, they're basically off the job because the project has to continue working, whether or not that particular subcontractor or contractor is available to work. So we totally understand that BOLI wants House Bill 2386 to help them deal with a certain number of bad actors in the state, but the authority that it would grant goes far beyond what's necessary for that. And by shifting the burden of proof to employers, it also shifts burdens of cost and time that are involved to address the order. So before advancing this bill, AOI asks that this committee and legislature take a good look at whether such authority is really warranted.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Eisen, representing Associated General Contractors. We have over 850 members in the commercial construction industry, spanning general, specialty, union, open shop, large, small contractors. And actually, almost everything that Ms. Earls covered are in my remarks as well. We have no disputing that for the truly bad actors that BOLI should have the tools to address that. Again, our biggest concern at this point is with Section 1 and the standard to issue a cease and desist order simply being reason to believe prior to any hearing, any obtaining any real evidence, no requirements for that, just the ability to issue a cease and desist. We have a lot of questions about that, the example that was given, I think, is a good one in terms of, for our membership, there are 40 or 50 different prevailing wage rates. If there is a allegation that one of them is being paid incorrectly or at a different rate, the ability there, based on this law, House Bill 2386, Commissioner would have the ability to just issue a cease and desist, which has the potential to even go as far as shutting down a project. Not saying that would happen in every case. So we'd like to be part of any discussions about maybe a better way to address that. But simply having a reason to believe standard in our mind doesn't rise to the level of what's necessary here. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at this, a reasonable standard, that would be just an employee making a claim that he feels he's receiving the wrong prevailing wage, and that could, making that claim, could actually get a project shut down.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I think that BOLI has something more specific in mind probably when they talk to you about this bill, but the fact is that it could be something as small as an employee complaining that they've been assigned work that's in the wrong wage class or are being paid incorrectly or any other thing under 653, 652.
Other questions? So you don't, you think that it's potential that the commissioner may have a reason that's somewhat frivolous then, or not based on anything?
What I think is, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I think is that once we put this into law, it'll be there. And this commissioner may not be apt to go out looking for, you know, a frivolous opportunity to shut down a project or issue a cease and desist order, but every commissioner's standard about a reason to believe is going to be different. So it's our position that we need something more specific in the law. Certainly BOLI needs the tools if they feel like they don't have them, but reason to believe is pretty vague for a long time into the future, which is where this would go.
Thank you. Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I guess this really takes due process and reverses it. Is that an accurate description?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenan Mar, I don't know if it... It shifts the burden of proof, basically. Yeah, it does.
But the process, excuse me.
No, go ahead.
But the process intervenes from the commissioner instead of going the other way and giving a time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that's exactly right, because the commissioner can issue the cease and desist order first without any notice or opportunity for hearing on the part of the employee, which is something that they would have under the current statutory scheme. So, yes.
Great. Right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I'll close public hearing on House Bill 2386. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2386? Not seeing any, so it remains closed. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2387 and 2212.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2387 authorizes the Labor Commissioner to administratively compel the employer to provide a bond when the employer fails to establish and maintain a regular payday. There are no amendments. And House Bill 2212 authorizes the Labor Commissioner to impose a civil penalty not to exceed $1,000 when an employer fails to pay wages on a regular payday, as long as the failure is not due to circumstances beyond the employer's control. There's no amendment.
Great. And again, can we have Paloma Sparks?
Good morning.
If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, representative members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2387. The Bureau has brought this forward, again, to make some changes to how our enforcement works. Under current law, we have the authority, commissioner has the authority, to require employers who are failing to pay wages or to maintain a regular payday to post a bond for wages. In practice, we use this tool when we have employers who are what we like to call return customers, where we have employers that are repeatedly violating the law in this area. So we have the authority to require them. What we don't have is the authority to enforce it. Right now, if we want to enforce a requirement that employer post a bond, we have to go to court, which means that we have to pay DOJ to represent us. This slows down the process. It also makes it so it costs a lot more in terms of state dollars. Again, if there was a case where an employer was simply ignored our requirement under this change that we could administratively enforce it, we would ask the circuit court to compel them. Current law requires that all employers establish and maintain a regular payday, that employees be paid no later than 35 days from the day they first worked or from their last paycheck. We feel like this is an important tool. When employees aren't getting their wages when they're supposed to, you know, a delay of 5 days becomes 10 days, becomes you can't pay your rent, you can't buy your groceries. This hurts Oregonians, it hurts their families, and so we think that the more efficiently we can respond to protect workers, the better off we all are. That, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going through, looking at the changes and everything, there's a $1,000 penalty in here. Is that so if you had 10 employees or 20 employees and didn't make payroll in time, would it be $1,000 or could be up to $1,000? Would it be for each employee for the one event?
Chair Holvey,
I think she was testifying on House Bill 2387 at this point.
I thought we were 2212.
We are, but she's not testifying to that.
We're on 2212, but she's not testifying to it.
I've opened a public hearing on both. She is providing testimony on House Bill 2387 at the moment. Okay. I believe that's accurate, is it not?
Yes, Chair Holvey, that is accurate.
Any other questions on House Bill 2387 for Ms. Sparks? Not seeing any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, I'd like to have Matt Swanson and Kate Newell.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. For the record, Kate Newhall, representing UA 290. We're here today in support of House Bill 2387 and believe that this is a very common sense proposal. If an employer has a pattern of not paying wages or failing to pay on regular paydays, we think it's critical and important to give the agency the extra tools that it needs to ensure that employees are paid. Paloma, I think, alluded to it, but a lot of employees that come in through Bowley's doors are really low-wage workers who are living paycheck to paycheck. And even a delay of a couple days or, you know, 1 day, 3 days, 5 days means that they're paying their rent late, their bills late, that they can't put food on the table or are incurring extra costs as a result of those late payments. So we believe it's essential to ensure that employees are due wages, they're able to get those wages in a fast process. I also would reiterate, I think that this is a tool that we see Bowley using for the most egregious and repeat offenders. I think there are instances where they have employers that they see again and again and again. And if an employer has this pattern of not paying employees wages, we believe that it is right to have an extra tool like posting a bond so that those employees can be assured that they're going to get paid. Thank you.
Hello again, members of the committee. My name is Matt Swanson, representing SEIU. A question for the chair. Did you want me to go into House Bill 2212 and for some background on that? Or
They are both open for public hearing at the moment.
So I would say as a broad category, we do support both House Bill 2212, authorizing a civil penalty that the commissioner can utilize in cases where the worst of the worst are really frequent flyers in the system, as well as House Bill 2387, requiring bonding. SEIU Local 49, one of SEIU locals in Oregon, represents employees with intellectual and physical disabilities who work for qualified rehabilitation facilities, otherwise known as QRFs. QRFs receive non-compete contracts from the state government for various goods and services. Within these companies, we see, you know, SEIU represented workers who are paid prevailing wages and always paid on time. But we also know that QRFs are not required to pay minimum wage, much less prevailing wage. And we have also seen instances where workers have brought cases of not being paid on time to us. One such instance happened with a QRF called Diversified Abilities at Portland State University, where workers were being given draw paychecks, which are essentially IOUs in lieu of regular paychecks. This, of course, for people who are working on the margins, low-paid, low-wage workers, this creates a challenge within their week-to-week, day-to-day budget, right? Additionally, it deprives the state of monies that are owed to different trusts that are paying unemployment insurance, etc. So this is a serious problem that the commissioner really does need tools to go after these bad employers. So not only are we talking about a violation of the law, but a violation of law where there's really no penalties for employers who are openly flouting it. So that's where the penalty question comes in, and what we think the main idea behind 2212 is that a law without much penalty is going to be easy to get around, and we've seen it happen in an industry with some of the state's most vulnerable workers. This would be a way to have an effective deterrent against such activity and provide a level playing field for all businesses, as well as providing an assurance that workers will be paid when the employer says they're going to be paid. So with that in mind, we encourage you to support passage of House Bill 2212 and House Bill 2387.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Up next, Mike Eliason and Betsy Earls.
Just keep everybody up here. It's not the same people today.
Good morning.
Okay.
And if you'd identify yourself again for the record, please.
It's nice to see you all again. I know. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. And I'm testifying only in opposition to House Bill 2387. We're not commenting on 2212. I'll just tell you broadly what our concern is with 2387 and then let Mike fill in some of the details. I think that AGC has some specifics they'd like to talk with you about. But we oppose House Bill 2387 because, again, it shifts the burden of proof in disputes about whether an employer is meeting a scheduled payday from the BOLI commissioner, who under current law does have a remedy in that they can go to court and petition the circuit court for a bond to the employer, who once an order is issued then has to go to the circuit court and petition to have it overturned. I think also the when House Bill 2387 is being offered in this context, we haven't seen a lot of evidence that there is a big problem in Oregon that would warrant this kind of broad new authority, just like under House Bill 2386. So again, we don't contest that there are some bad actors in Oregon and that BOLI may need more tools to deal with them. But at this point, we would point out to you that they do have a remedy right now, which is the circuit court, and we would support remaining with that one.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Mike Eliason representing Associated General Contractors. And our main issue with this bill, although we agree with what Ms. Earls stated, is with Section 2, which extends the period of time the commissioner may require an employer to post a bond in response to wage claims from a maximum of 6 months to, quote, a future period the commissioner considers appropriate, which, in other words, could be an indefinite amount. And in our opinion, there should be a cap. And if 6 months, the current law, which states no more than 6 months, if that isn't sufficient, we're open to talking about what would be sufficient. But in just stating an indefinite amount or a period of time, you know, however the commissioner deems appropriate, you know, potentially puts employers in a bad situation. There are some small employers, especially, who may not be able to get a bond for an indefinite period. You know, so we would suggest a reasonable and finite amount of time, whether 6 months is inappropriate or not enough. Again, we're willing to talk about what that could be, but that's our main concern with the bill. And we have no comment at this time on House Bill 2212.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Not seeing any.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kinnamer.
I wondered if it would be possible to have Ms. Sparks come back, because one of the questions that I failed to ask was how often they see this as an issue, and it seems to me that's a rather critical question.
Right,
I apologize for that oversight. In reviewing this, I had brought that to my attention, and I overlooked my own note.
I think she'd be willing to come back up. She's not running for the door, so.
Let's see. Yeah. Nope.
And if you'd introduce yourself for the record again, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Paloma Sparks from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I don't have actual numbers for you. I would say that we don't see it a ton, but we do have definitely some employers that are our repeat customers, frequent flyers. But I can get you the actual numbers.
Yeah, would you get us some data? Thank you very
Happy
much,
to.
Mr. Chair.
So one question, how does the commissioner see the current process of falling short that going through the courts instead of offering this bond?
Chair Holvey, the current issue is that
Anytime we go to court for any reason, we have to pay DOJ to represent us. We have to make sure that somebody is available for when we want to do this. That takes some taxpayer money. Our administrative process is pretty good, can be really efficient. And again, if an employer always has the right to appeal our administrative decisions.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, in that regard, how long is the delay typically if you decide to move towards court on this process?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Kenemer, it can really depend on sort of what does the court docket look like, what does the DOJ availability look like. It just sort of depends on what we're looking at. You know, to get a hearing can sometimes take quite a long time.
Any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2387 and House Bill 2212. That concludes our public hearings. We have no introduction of committee bills at this point. So with that, I will close the House Committee on Business and Labor.
That was quite masterful. Thank you.